At this time, the chairperson should briefly qualify. Requirements for chairing a meeting at the Central Orlando Group Saturday night speakers meeting is 1 year of continuous sobriety and attendance at a group conscious meeting. Mine's Brian. I'm an alcoholic. I've done both of those, and Central's my home group. My sobriety date is April 12th, 2008. It's not my first sobriety date, but it's the most recent one, and it's the best one. I think I have the best sobriety today. I had some years without a drink. I got angry, bitter, pissed off at my higher power, and I started drinking again, and I gave away everything I ever had obtained in my first sobriety, because before I got sober the first time, I was homeless for like a year and a half. So I obtained a lot of things, material, people, spiritual, and when I started to relapse, I started to really get pissed off at my higher power. Drank till everything was gone, and I was not homeless. I had a spot to sleep in jail, but I came here. I was pissed off. I didn't want to do the steps. I started to do them, and my life got better one day at a time. This program works. I have a higher power back. I have people in here who talk to me all the time. Nobody wanted to talk to me when I first got out of jail, and I didn't want to talk to myself. So life is getting better one day at a time, 1 minute at a time, whatever it takes. I love this program, and I'm glad I'm here. The group asked me to remind you to please make sure your phones are off and refrain from moving around or talking while the speaker is sharing. And introduce my speaker. I was at this young lady's first meeting. I was chairing it. She probably thought I was a psychopath, but I've seen her grow through this program. I've seen her do the steps, do the deal, and she never spoke before, and about a month ago, she came down and had to speak at a different place that I was chairing, and now she's on speaker tour, so it might sound a little professional tonight. She's speaking all over the country, but I'm going to introduce Emily to you, so I really enjoy seeing her grow in this program, and I'm real proud of her. So here's Emily.
Hey, everybody. My name is Emily, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm really, really grateful to be here. My sobriety date is May 27th, 2009, and I'm just really happy. You know, I'm surrounded by so many friends and family tonight, and I just feel so much gratitude, you know, and if you drank the way I drank, you know, it's truly a miracle that we're all here. And alive and smiling, you know. So I'm just going to tell you a little bit about what it was like, you know, what happened and what it's like now, and share my experience, strength, and hope with you. So I'm from Rhode Island, small state up north, Yankee northern girl, born and raised. All my family is there, but truly today I like to consider myself a Floridian. I love it down here. Grew up in a middle-class family, you know. My mom didn't work when we were young. My dad's a truck driver, so, you know, we never had a lot of money, but things were taken care of, you know, clothes on our back, food on our table. You know, I have a little brother. He's 4 years younger than me, so for the first 4 years of my life, I think I was very spoiled. My mom's dream was kind of to be a mother. That was what she always wanted to do. She wanted to get married and raise a family. So my dad, he worked a lot. My mom was always very constant in my life, you know. From the moment I was born, you know, it was her and I. And I'm a little nervous. Like Brian said, I've been speaking a lot, but when you're in front of your home group, it's a little bit different. But, yeah, I grew up in Rhode Island. I grew up around alcohol from a very young age. I come from a family of alcoholics. My dad's still actively drinking, so I learn from a very young age the way that you have fun, the way you party, the way you cope is always with alcohol. You know, any family function, my dad was always the drunkest, the loudest. You know, he thought he was the funniest guy in the room. And so I started to see from a young age that it was kind of an embarrassment to me, you know, very young. My grandparents, they have a bar in their basement. You know, holidays were who's mixing drinks in the basement for everybody. You know, what kind of cocktail do you want? They had every kind of booze. It wasn't like just beer or wine. It was like, what kind of mixed drinks do you want? And you could get it, you know, fully stocked bar at all times. And, you know, the worse my dad's drinking got, he also gambled, you know, and so that goes hand in hand. And, you know, he was never physically abusive, but definitely mentally abusive, you know. my mom, I can always remember her saying, you know, my dad made her feel really small. You know, she never had a really a life of her own. You know, it was pretty much my dad's friends, what my dad did. And that's how it went, you know. But I was very lucky, you know. My mom finally did start working again. My aunt and uncle own an oil company, and she was a secretary there. And that kind of pretty much paid for me to go to private school, because the school system up north where I was from, the public schools were pretty bad, and they wanted to make sure that, you know, I was, you know, I didn't fall into the trap of drugs and drinking and gangs and, you know, the whole deal. So I went to Catholic school, and, you know, I was brought up, you know, pretty religious. I come from a Catholic family, so I started, you know, I made my first communion, and I was an altar server, and I taught CCD for a little while. So God was pretty present in my life, but I knew, you know, he was up there and, you know, tried to be a good little girl. And, you know, my mom took me to church, but that was pretty much the extent. I never had a relationship with him until I came into AA. But, you know, I didn't start drinking very young. You know, I was very, you know, they call it straight edge, you know. And when I got to high school, I just got very involved, you know, jack of all trades. I played sports. I got straight A's. You know, I was in plays. I was given music lessons from a very young age. I've been playing piano since I was six. So, you know, I was given a lot of gifts from my family, you know, but through this time, my relationship with my dad deteriorated because we're very much alike, very pig-headed, you know, strong-minded, strong-willed, and, you know, whenever he would get drunk, I would stand up to him, you know. I don't like what you're doing. You're drunk, Dad. And my dad is a drinker of denial. He'll be totally wasted and tell you that he hasn't even had a drink. So, you know, you're wasted, Dad. I haven't even had a drink. You're like, whatever, Dad, obviously. You know, I've been seeing you drinking all day. So, you know, the anger and resentment started. And, you know, once I got to high school, my mom had always said, which I remember, that once his drinking started to affect the kids, that was when she would leave him. And so, you know, she found out that he was in a lot of debt from gambling, and, you know, he had taken out a second mortgage on the house that my mom didn't know about. And so finally, you know, she had had enough and decided that we were going to leave. And my brother and I went to live with my mom. They sold the house, and my dad moved back in with his parents, who I now see is today as very good enablers, because he still lives with them today. So I went to live with my mom. My brother would go. You know, my dad always wanted a son. I think if I would have been a boy, they probably wouldn't have had any more kids after me. But I was a girl, so my dad begged my mom to have another child. But he, you know, took my brother to sports and stuff like that. And it was probably a personal decision. You know, if I would have wanted to be with my dad more, I probably could have been. But, you know, I didn't like the drinking. He drank and drove a lot. You know, he picked my brother up from sporting events drunk. And, you know, I didn't like that. And I didn't want to go in the car with him. So around high school was pretty much the end of our relationship, unless I needed money, you know. Dad! You know, and I felt like I was entitled to that, you know, because he had never been there for me, and he had a drinking problem, and, you know, the way that I felt like he showed he loved me was to give me some cash, you know. So that was pretty much how our relationship went up until I came into AA. You know, if I needed something, or I was in trouble, or, you know, I needed my insurance paid, you know, I called my dad for those things. But other than that, you know, he was an alcoholic, and I didn't want anything to do with him. It's kind of funny, because now when I think back in high school, I was on Students Against Drunk Driving, and I had a boyfriend in high school who I caught smoking a cigarette, and I was like, you're a junkie, smoking a cigarette, you know. And people would say to me, you know, you're going to drink, you know, you're going to change, you're going to go to college, and you're going to drink. And, you know, and I would say, no, that's never going to happen. And now I'm speaking at an AA meeting, so. But, you know, high school was good. I graduated with straight A's, and I got, they had a University of Rhode Island. I applied there, and, you know, it was, if you lived in the state, you get a really good, you know, deal to go there. And I really only had to pay, like, room and board and stuff like that, maybe, like, $1,500 to go to school. So, you know, we decided that it was a really good decision. So, I applied and I got in, and so I was going to go to the University of Rhode Island. And around this time is when my mom, she never dated through 4 years of high school. You know, she basically, you know, did a lot for my brother and I. And this is when she started to really get her roots going on. You know, she'd always lived in my dad's shadow and just finally decided that she could have her own life, you know. And she got a boyfriend, and of course I didn't like that because I wasn't number one anymore. And, he had two young daughters, and their mom wasn't present, so she really started to raise his kids, and I hated that. You know, it bothered me that, you know, she wasn't spending as much time with me anymore, and that, you know, pretty much the summer of my senior year, she stayed over his house all the time, and it came around time for me to move into school, and she told me that my dad was going to move me in. She had something to do. And that, like, I was so mad. You know, this is your baby girl moving into school, and you're not going to be there and move me in, you know, and this, you know. But my dad came and moved me in, and, you know, I don't really remember how it happened, to be honest with you. You know, my roommates, I'll just say that drugs are a part of my story, but I respect AA, so, you know, we'll just call them mixed drinks, as Heidi calls them. And, you know, we'll refer to them as that. And I had a roommate that used mixed drinks, like, to smoke them, and... And the other roommate liked to drink, and it just kind of, you know, one day it just seemed like it was a good idea. Like, I can't say how it happened, you know, but I just figured, you know, I was in college and, you know, I could probably handle it. And as soon as I picked up that first drink, I really feel like I drank alcoholically. You know, I would blackout drunk all the time. I remember going to fraternity parties and stumbling home and, you know, just the insanity. And, you know, the girl who had all these hopes and dreams, you know, as soon as I started drinking, they were gone. I never went to class. I don't even remember studying for one test. I would sleep all day and just go to parties at night. And by Christmas break of my first semester in school, I was telling my mom I was moving home. You know, I couldn't do school anymore. I couldn't do school because I was failing out. You know, I hadn't gone to class a single day. Maybe the first week, you know. And so she said, okay, baby, you can come home. You can come live with me and you can go to community college. You know, maybe you just weren't ready to live away from home. You know, maybe whatever. Just because she didn't know. She didn't know I was drinking. She just thought, you know, I'm sure I shed her some bullshit excuse of why I wanted to come home, which I don't really remember. But I moved home and I was going to go to community college. By this time, she was living with a boyfriend and he was a lot younger than her, so it was a weird situation, you know, because he was like the middle of my age and her age. So, you know, it was just kind of awkward. And I would never say that he really liked me, but, you know, there was some inappropriate, you know, whatever. So it was weird. And I didn't want to be there. So, you know, what do you want to do to make your parents proud? You start hanging around a tattoo parlor. You know, I got my first tattoo and I was like, yes, these are the people I want to hang around with. This is the lifestyle I want. This is so cool. And if you ever hung around a tattoo parlor, you know that they party all night. They go to work at noon. They use mixed drinks to do tattoos and get inspiration. And I don't know. So I started hanging around and there was a particular tattoo artist that started working there that I liked. So, of course, I was like, this is going to be my new boyfriend. It's going to be so awesome. And, you know, we dated for a little while and it was two people in an alcoholic relationship, you know. And around this time, you know, I stopped going to school completely. I enrolled in the community college, but I never went. And I met this man and I, you know, moved in right away with him because he was my ticket out of my mom's house. And I started my career as a bartender. And it was very convenient because I could combine my two favorite things at once, drinking and partying, and get paid for it. And my life at that time kind of just revolved around one little block. The bar was next door to the tattoo parlor, and we lived upstairs from the tattoo parlor. So it was hang out during the day, everybody get tattooed and come over and hang out. And at this time, my drinking, you know, I would always get out of control. I'd always be the one that they're like, Emily, why are you drinking so much? Like, what, you know, I could never stop. You know, once I took that first drink, it was blackout drunk. You know, I never could go out and have one or two. It was like, let's drink the whole bottle. Let's do, who wants to do a shot? You know, let's get this party started. And that's where I was introduced to my favorite mixed drink, which just allowed to sober me up so that I can maintain, you know, and keep me appropriate and, you know, keep me hanging around for the rest of the night, you know. And it really started to spiral out of control at that point. You know, I didn't want to go out drinking because I knew I couldn't drink the way I really wanted to drink unless I had the other stuff. And so it started to become a problem, and I started to recognize that that was a problem. And I ended up in the hospital. And my mom came to see me when I was in the hospital. I ended up in the hospital a couple times, you know, from weekend partying, you know, and my mom came to see me like the third time, and she was like, you know, you're going to have to get some help. I'm not going to come see you in the hospital again like this. And they wouldn't put you in rehab at the time because you don't get physically addicted to the mixed drink, you know, and I remember her sitting there asking me, do you have a problem with alcohol? No, I don't have a problem with alcohol. I have a problem with the other stuff. And she was like, well, they won't put you in rehab for that. You have to say you have a problem with alcohol. And I was like, no, I don't. And that was the end of that. And but I did decide to start going to, like, some NA-type stuff. And they had a counselor that I spoke to. And I remember he was the first person that kind of told me that I was an alcoholic. And he said, you know, you'll never safely be able to use alcohol. And I was like, you don't know what you're talking about. You know, I use alcohol just fine. And I'm going to keep doing it, you know. And but I could kind of see how you know, I've been fired from numerous bartending jobs, you know, drinking on the job or, you know, giving away free drinks or, you know, not charging people for drinks, putting the money in my tip cup. You know, just things that you do when you're a bartender. And, you know, my dad, his friend opened a warehouse and they said, you know, we can get your daughter a job here if she wants a job, you know. So I was like, yeah, I was probably about to lose the job I had. You know, it was probably on the rocks. So my dad told me that he could get me this job. I was like, okay, I'll take it. And so I started working there. And I was reading the 12 and 12 today, and it says that alcoholics, something about how we're really hard workers. You know, they have a higher earning potential because they have to work so hard. And I really believe that's true for myself because, you know, to drink the way I drank. As soon as I started working at this warehouse, I was still drinking a lot, but I moved up the chain very, very fast. You know, I could talk a good talk. I realized that, you know, managing people was something that I liked to do. But maintaining my drinking and doing that at the same time made it really hard. You know, I'd come in every morning and I'd be throwing up in the bathroom till about 10 or 11 till I could hold some food down and then try to manage some people and, you know, whatever. I tried to make it work and I thought that I was hiding it very well, you know, which they kept promoting me, so, you know, they probably knew, but, you know. But I got as high as I could get in the warehouse. The gentleman that was above me, he was an older gentleman, and he was going to retire with the company, so he was the head of the warehouse. So there was no way I was going to take his job, so I was as high as I could go. And there was a couple warehouses. I worked for this company called Bodick and Rhodes, and they had a warehouse down here in Florida, and they had a really hard time finding good employees, and they needed a supervisor. So one day, the head of the company came in and asked me if I'd be interested in relocating for a job. And said, sure, you know, why not? My whole family lives in Rhode Island. Nobody's ever got out. You know, it's an opportunity for me to get out. Hell yeah, I'll take it. So he's like, we're going to send you to Florida, and, you know, if you like the warehouse and you want the job, it's yours, but you have to move right away. You know, you can't take your time on the decision because we need somebody right away. So I think that was on like a Thursday, and by a Monday they flew me down here, and you know, I flew into Orlando Airport, and before I even like saw the warehouse, as soon as I got off the plane, saw the palm trees and the sunshine, I was like, I'll take it. It's for me. You know, I didn't even see the warehouse or know what I was getting myself into. But I did come check it out, and I knew it was gonna be hard work, but I didn't care, you know. I found an apartment pretty quick while I was down here over by SeaWorld, and, you know, I came back home, and they shipped a couple boxes for me, and I packed up everything else that fit in my car, and I had no one here, you know, no friends, no family, and I just said, you know what, I'm going to do this, and packed up my car and drove down here and moved into my little place, and I was like, this is it, this is my dream, you know, I have a really great job, I'm making good money, I'm away from my family. And, you know, this is it for me. And, you know, but I took me with me. And, you know, as soon as I got down here, the complex where I lived in, they had a deal with the Motorcycle Mechanics Institute, where they could get discounted rates to stay in the apartments there. So it was full of, motorcycle guys. And I was probably like one of five girls there. So, you know, it's my alcoholic dream. You know, tons and tons of boys everywhere. And they all, you know, if you know anything about mechanics, well, most of the ones I know, they like to drink and party. And it just turned into one huge party. You know, as soon as I got down here, I felt like I was on permanent vacation. You know, the weather was nice. People liked to drink, or those are the people that I sought out to hang around with, you know. And I started drinking very, very heavily, you know, and I was really stressed under the job because everyone's Southern, and you have a young, white, Yankee girl come in to run a warehouse in the South. You know, they gave me a lot of shit when I first moved down here. You know, they didn't want to listen to me or take direction. They didn't know what I was talking about. So when I get out of work, you know, that's the way I cope with things is to get drunk. And, you know, the guys would, you know, they really fed me a lot of attention when I came home from work. They'd always have drinks waiting for me, you know, here you go. And I'm like, this is great, you know. And so I moved down here in January of 07, and March 7th, 2007, I came home from a really long day at work, and they were making Mai Tais. And I can remember drinking the Mai Tais, like no mixer, and then at one point I'm just swigging from the bottle, so you know, I was feeling pretty good. And we decided we were going to go swimming and break into the pool, because they lock it around 9 or 10. So we broke into the pool, and we were hanging around, and I decided I'm going to dive over my friend Thomas, and I went to dive into the pool, and I hit the bottom. And I climbed back out, and I laid on the side of the pool, and I felt like something was wrong, like I had, like, hurt my skull or something. And so I said, I think someone needs to call 911. Something's not right. So they called 911, and then I said, nah, never mind. Hang up the phone. I'll sleep it off, you know, because I was so wasted. And I climbed over the fence and went back upstairs to my apartment and then laid down, and I was like, no, something's really wrong. We're going to have to call 911. So the ambulance came, and they took me to Turkey Lake Hospital. And that's where I found out that I had broken my neck and that I fractured my first and fifth vertebrae. And so they life-flighted me downtown to Orlando Regional. And I have to say this to you, that it never once crossed my mind that I broke my neck because of drinking. You know, that wasn't even a glimmer in my mind. You know, I broke my neck, I'm a victim, this is terrible, I hope I'm not paralyzed. You know, I just remember wiggling my fingers and toes every day to make sure that, you know, I wasn't paralyzed. And this started my month-long stay at Orlando Regional. They decided to put me in a halo. And if you know anything about a halo, it's the girl's worst nightmare because it's not very attractive at all. It's screwed into your head in four places with two bars and, like, this big chest piece. And you know, I didn't know what I was going to do. I didn't want to tell my parents. I didn't want to worry them, and I didn't want to be a failure. So, you know, I didn't really know what I was going to do, and at this point, I didn't know if I was going to be able to walk. You know, I couldn't sit up or anything until about 2.5 weeks, I think, into my stay there when I sat up for the first time. But, you know, this is where my friend Dean comes into the story. He lived down in Orlando, and I have a mutual friend up north that he's friends with, and I was supposed to call him when I first came down here, and he was going to show me around. And, you know, I was like, I'm not calling some weird older dude that I don't know to show me around. You know, I want to drink and party. I don't have time for this guy. And if it wasn't for him, I wouldn't be here today, and I wouldn't be here. If I wasn't in Florida, I don't think I would have gotten sober. So I know he truly had a huge part in my recovery and my sobriety. I'm truly grateful for that. But my friends up north called him and said, you need to go check on this girl because we don't know what's going on with her. She's in the hospital. We heard she broke her neck, but we don't know what's going on. So he came to check on me, and he came to check on me every single day after that in the hospital. And, you know, that's why I was able to stay here. You know, his mom made me shirts with Velcro because I couldn't wear a regular shirt. And he brought me groceries, and he took me to all my doctor's appointments, and I'm just truly grateful for him, you know, because he was a really good friend to me when I had no one down here. And so, you know, he came and hung out with me, and I was able to go home and take care of myself. You know, I could walk, and everything was, you know, I knew I was going to be okay. I knew it was going to be a long road to recovery, but I knew I was going to be okay. So I got to move back into my apartment, and what do you think is the first thing I did when I got home? Who's taking me to the liquor store? So I went right back to drinking and using mixed drinks in my halo, you know? And that's, you know, Vanessa likes to share, you know, I'm in the halo taking the shot, and that's true, you know? I went right back to drinking, and those guys that I was hanging around with before came back hanging around, and at this point is where I met another friend of mine, my friend Adam. He had a lot of injuries himself. He was a motorcycle rider, so when he saw me in my halo, he kind of said, this is the girl for me, you know, and You know, him and Dean were kind of my sidekicks through recovery. You know, they took me everywhere, and I truly believe that's why I'm standing here in front of you, because they didn't treat me like I was in a halo, which you may think is a bad thing, but it got me to walk around. You know, if I would have had someone babying me and making me sit, I don't know if I would have gotten as strong or fast. And it was my goal to get back to work. But, you know, I was in the halo for so long, and I drank and smoked cigarettes at my neck didn't heal, and I was in it for 5 months that job was no longer available to me anymore once I was better. But so I'm hanging out with Dean and Adam, and I got very, very close with Adam's parents, and you know, they became like my second family. You know, we were always at their house, you know, doing some sort of shenanigans. You know, the two of us together really pulled a lot of, you know, we just caused a lot of trouble and had a lot of fun. And on 4th of July, we were hanging out, and I got into a car accident. We were driving, and I don't know, we were arguing over something. We like to argue a lot. And I whipped the wheel, and I told my car. And I found out at that point that I had no insurance, because I had been on my dad's insurance the whole time, because I'm entitled, you owe me to pay my insurance. I'm 20-something years old. And I lost my license. So, you know, at that point, Adam kind of had to drive me around, and I was back bartending again, and I was spending a lot of time at his house out in Claremont, and, you know, we drank a lot together, and, you know, but he was really a good friend to me, and his family was very good to me, and we got very, very close. And one night I was working, and, I got a phone call from his mom, and she let me know that Adam was no longer with us. And a car pulled out in front of him, and he died instantly. And that really rocked my world. I never lost anyone close to me before like that. So it was the first kind of bit of grief that I had to deal with, and I didn't deal with it. I drank. I just started drinking all the time. And his mom and I are very close, and after he passed away, I kind of got very distant from her. You know, we still talked on the phone and wrote cards and stuff like that, but it wasn't like how it was before. And all I can say is, I started to drink every day, and I got into another relationship pretty fast, because I didn't want to be alone, and I didn't know how to cope. But I'm grateful for that relationship, because this man planted the seed in me, and that's why I'm here. His mom was an alcoholic, and she had about 4 years sober. And when we started dating, my drinking got pretty bad. And one night I stayed out all night, and I didn't come home. And he said, you know what, you're an alcoholic, and I'm going to leave you if you don't get sober. And I said, yeah, whatever. You know, I'll get sober. I made promises I was going to go to a meeting, but I never went. And then 2 weeks later, we went out one night, and we got into an altercation, and I punched him in the face. And so he said, you know, I'm going to have to leave you. You know, your drinking's out of control, and you need to go to AA. And that was the first time that anyone had really, you know, I'd heard from the counselors before, you know, but that was the first time that it really clicked in my mind that, you know, my drinking was out of control and that maybe I needed to come here. But I didn't know anything about AA, and the seed was planted. I drank a little, you know, for a couple more months, and I went home. And I remember thinking when I went home, it got to the point where if I didn't have a drink by, like, 6 or 7 o'clock, I was really, like, anxious, and I couldn't sleep. And as soon as I had a drink, like, the anxiety was gone, and, you know, I had no problem sleeping because I was blacked out drunk. And I remember thinking in my head, this is what it feels like to be an alcoholic. And I didn't care. I drank a little longer. And, you know, Memorial Day weekend of last year, it was no different weekends than any other weekend if you drank like I drank. You know, it's just Memorial Day weekend. I drank all weekend. And I was living, Dean and I got a place at the time. And I was living with Dean, and I woke up Monday morning, and I had a really bad panic attack, and I couldn't breathe. And I truly believe that panic attack was from God, and I believe that people's prayers are what got me in these rooms. And, you know, I just couldn't do it anymore. I couldn't live my life like that anymore. I couldn't take it. And, you know, everything was just, like, building up and building up. So I went to Dean, and I was like, Dean, can you throw all this alcohol away when I get home from work, and can you take me to a meeting? And he said, sure, I am. I'll take you to a meeting. And he brought me here. And I was scared and nervous, and I came in here, and, you know, I just saw so many people that had done the deal and that were happy and they had a life, you know, today, and they were successful. And I was like, wow, you know, and I heard you share and I could relate. I mean, Brian shared the first meeting and I heard what I needed to hear. He doesn't normally share that he broke his neck. Yeah, I haven't heard him talk about that since, but he had said that he broke his neck, and that was like my first like correlation to, you know, being able to relate to the people in the rooms. And they said, you know, work these steps. And, you know, to be honest with you, the only step that made sense to me was the first step when I got here, and I'm truly grateful for that because I knew I was an alcoholic when I got here. That I didn't struggle with at all. I knew I was powerless, and my life was definitely a mess. So, you know, step one, I was like, I get that. Yep, step one. Got it. The rest, I have no idea what they, you know, what they mean, but you told me to get a sponsor, and, you know, for a long time, I'd been trying to manage my own life, and I never took anybody's advice. I never did what anyone told me to do. You told me to get a sponsor, and I was like, you know what? I'm going to listen. I'm going to listen and do what these people say. So I asked Robin to sponsor me, and she told me no. And if you know Robin, she has tons and tons of sponsees, but she told me no. And she said, well, why don't, you know, she asked me if I would work with one of her girls, you know, and I was like, no, you know, I really think that I'm going to be able to bullshit her, so I'm going to need someone who's going to, you know, tell me the truth. And I know that was God, because if you know Robin, she's very, very honest, and that's definitely what I needed. And, you know, we got right, she was like, you need to go to a meeting every day, you need to work steps in 6 months, you need to call me, and if you don't do it, I'm just way too busy. So I was like, you know what, if I'm going to work with this woman, and, you know, she's so busy and so successful that I'm going to need to do the work, and I can't waste her time, you know. So we got right into working the steps, and I told her I didn't understand them, and she told me, you know, you'll start working them and you won't even know it. And she told me to start praying in the morning for God to keep me sober. And when I first came in here, I didn't think a day would go by that I wouldn't think about a drink, having a drink, you know. And I thought about it a lot, especially in those first 30 days. You know, I'd call her, something would go wrong at work, and I'd want to take a drink. And, you know, but when I started praying, you know, and asking God to keep me sober, that was step three. You know, that was me giving it up to God, and, you know, me just, you know, knowing that I couldn't do it alone and that he would have to, you know, keep me sober. And, you know, we got to the fourth step, and I was doing the work and calling her and doing the work and calling her, and she told me we were going to meet and do the fifth step. And that's where I truly believe that I really started to change when I did the fourth step. You know, I talked about my dad and had all these daddy issues, and, you know, through working the fourth step, I was able to see him as a sick person. And I never, ever thought about that before. You know, I never thought of my dad having a problem and he didn't have a plan, program of recovery. And A taught me that it's my job is, you know, not to take my dad's inventory, but to be a good daughter and a good sister and a good employee. And, you know, so I really was able to forgive my dad at that point, you know, and I just wanted to have some sort of relationship with him, you know, regardless of, you know, it was just my job to call him and see how he was doing, and, I need that. No, I'm just kidding. So yeah, I started to see my dad as a sick person, and the fifth step was good because I finally got to see my part in things, and I never ever saw, you know, I was always the victim, everybody always left me, everyone always abandoned me, you know, but I started to see that, you know, it was probably because of my actions that those things happen. And, you know, they say, like, people in our lives inevitably hurt us because of things that we've done. And then we got to the eighth step, and I was all gung-ho until I got to the eighth step, and that's really where I kind of, like, halted a little bit due to fear. But I realized that the fear of doing something is far worse than actually taking the action to do it. And around this time, I was blessed because my mom got to come. She got to see me sober at this point when I was up to my eighth step, and, you know, this is where I started having a couple of spiritual awakenings. And like I told you, I didn't really talk to Adam's parents that much. Right after he passed away, my mom had a friend back home who used to make these teddy bears out of people who passed away's clothes. And so I had come over to, you know, it was like a year ago, I'd gotten some clothes from Mary of Adam's. And I wanted to have this bear made for her. And the lady made it at her own pace. You know, you got it when you got it. And it just so happened when my mom flew down that she had the bear made of his clothes. And it was right around the eighth step time, you know. So, you know, that's God. You know, I was able to send her the bear and send her a letter and tell her that I was sober. And, you know, it was truly amazing, you know, to be able to tell them they're so supportive of me and they love me so much. And, you know, she's always been there for me. And, you know, that she just couldn't express to me how proud they were of me, because she definitely saw me at my worst, you know. And I also got to go back to Adam's grave, and I hadn't been there since he passed, because it was too hard, you know, and I think alcoholics hold on to pain because we drink over it, you know. And, sorry, I went there with my sponsor, and when he first passed away, we brought a peace lily. My mom and I brought a peace lily to the funeral, and on the eighth step, when I went to make my amends to him, Robin and I were blabbing the jab on our way out there, and I'd been to Claremont numerous times, and we missed the exit. So we ended up taking another exit, and we went to Publix that we wouldn't have gone to if we had gone the right way, and we walked in, and there was a peace lily there. So I knew that was God telling me that it was going to be okay, and that, people are here for a reason. You know, God took him for a reason, and there's a reason why I'm still here. And that he's in a better place. And so that was huge for me. And I'm crying a little bit, you know, but I couldn't even talk about him before. You know, so for me to stand in front of you and be able to talk to you about him is a huge step for me. And so that was, you know, another spiritual awakening through working the program. And, you know, my life just started to get a lot better. You know, I called my dad and we talked today, you know, a couple times a month or a week, you know, whenever I call him. And when I first started calling him, he was like, "What's wrong? What do you need?" You know, he doesn't say that anymore. "No, Dad, I'm just calling to check on you. You know, we're working on a relationship today, you know." And sometimes I call him and he's sober, and sometimes I call him and he's drunk, and, you know, it is what it is, but it's just my job to call him and check on him today. And the same thing with my mom. And, you know, my roommates are here, and there came a point in my program where I had to get out of where I was living, and they said, "You know what, we'll get a two-bedroom." And I was like, "Are you guys sure?" You know, because my license has been suspended, but I was finally able to get it back through working the program and save some money, you know, and I'm going to get a car next month, and I actually have a savings account today, which I didn't know what that was before I came in the program. And so we're going to get an apartment, which is across the street from where I work, and you know, they had offered to move into a two-bedroom, and, you know, they were going to have to move all their stuff, and the place we live is really, really big. And then they came to me and said, "We're going to be able to move across the hall." And that's God, you know what I mean? That's God. All they had to do was move their stuff from one apartment across the hall, and we thought we were going to have to move, like, way down. So that's just another spiritual awakening that I had. And, you know, my life is just totally different today. And, you know, I try to do 10 and 11 the best I can, take an inventory of my day. And step 12 has just been amazing, to be able to be of service, you know, to be able to speak, to be able to work with another alcoholic. The women have saved, my sponsor likes to say, the men will pat your ass, the woman will save it. And, you know, that's the truth, you know. And I love my women's meetings that I go to. I love going out to dinner with the ladies. I love the relationships that I have today with the woman, you know, because I had no girlfriends before, and I know that's true of a lot of us in here. You know, you've taught me how to be a friend. You've taught me how to have a woman, to be a woman with dignity and grace, you know. And I work with the sponsee now, and it's just so amazing to see the change in her, to do a four-step with her, you know. And you know, I just prayed before the fourth step, and I try to pray with her before we do everything and invite God in, because I know it's always better when he's there. And, you know, the fourth step, when I'm giving her, you know, answers to her problems, or, you know, helping her find a solution, I know that's God, because my thinking, you know, got me in here. So, you know, just things that were coming out of me, I know that he's definitely directing my thinking today. And, you know, getting sober young, I thought, was when I first came in here, was going to suck. You know, I'm like, this is shitty. I'm going to have all these functions to go to, and I'm not going to be able to drink. And now I know that it's a blessing. You know, I don't have to live the rest of my life. And, you know, the damage that I did in 5 years of drinking was enough. You know, I have a lot of financial amends to make, which I haven't made them all today. But, I've made some of them, and, you know, I'm just going to continue to do that. And I don't have any regrets about my first year of sobriety. I know everything's a learning experience, but I will touch upon the relationship piece. And, you know, I was reading the 12 and 12, and it never really made sense to me until today when I read it before I came in here, where it says boy meets girl on AA campus, and when love at first sight follows. That didn't make sense to me until today, because if you fall in love with somebody at first sight, you don't know them, you know, and you haven't taken time to get to know them and grow. You kind of just jump into a relationship mess, you know. And, you know, what attracts you when you first come in doesn't attract you after you do the work and you grow and you change, you know. So, you know, I didn't always take every one of my sponsor suggestions, you know. They like to call me Marsha, but I did, you know, I did follow up here and there, you know. But it's always a learning experience, and I believe that God places people in our lives to bring us to the next level of serenity. And I know everybody that's been along my journey has truly brought out the best in me, and I'm just, you know, so grateful to be sober. And you know, my sponsor, I really look up to her and everything that she does, and I just think she's such an amazing woman. She has changed my life so much, and you know, there's nothing I could say up here in words I can express to you, you know, our relationship or what she's taught me, but I'm just really grateful for her, and I love her so much. And she ends her talk with something out of the Big Book, so I have to be just like her. And she has a story that she really likes, and I have a story that I really like, so I'm going to end with a little something out of that. You said as long as I put AA first in my life, everything that I put second would be first class. This has proved to be true over and over again, so I continue to put AA and God first, and everything I ever lost was returned many times over. So here I am, sober, successful, serene. Just a few of the gifts of the program for surrendering, suiting up, and showing up for life every day. Good days and bad days, reality is a wild ride, and I wouldn't miss it for the world. I don't question how this program works. I trust in my God, stay involved in AA service, go to lots of meetings, work with others, and practice the principles of the steps to the best of my willingness each day. I don't know which of these keeps me sober, and I'm not about to try to find out. It's worked for quite a few days now, so I think I'll try it again tomorrow. Thank you guys so much.